For WTOP News, it's The Book Report. I'm Tariq King. Do you remember a time in your childhood when getting the hottest new toy felt like a matter of life or death?
By the power of Grayskull,
if you were a child in the 80s, 90s, or after, Gen Xers may remember sending their parents on missions to track down model Star Wars X-Wing fighters, He-Man, or G.I. Joe action figures, while young millennials went nuts for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and Pokemon toys. But what are the consequences when developing young brains are saturated with the same kind of marketing bombardment that was originally used in Red Scare propaganda? On this edition of The Book Report, Brian Box Brown, cartoonist and author of The He-Man Effect, How American Toy Makers Sold You Your Childhood. The He-Man Effect traces how media companies and toy manufacturers, powered by the advent of television and the Reagan 80s deregulation era, joined forces to dominate the psyches of American children, and how this has shaped and affected the adults they became. It's a complex and important topic, and it's made digestible and accessible because Brian Box Brown has told this story in a comic book format. On the eve of the book's release, I sat down with him, and here is our book report interview with Brian Box Brown about the He-Man Effect. Great to have you today, Brian. I'll begin by asking the question that I ask everyone about every book. What is this book about?
It's kind of about this feeling of nostalgia, right? I'm interested in these vintage toys and stuff from my youth, He-Man especially. And I was at a toy convention near my house in Philadelphia, and, you know, it was packed with people. Just like packed with people buying He-Man stuff, G.I. Joe stuff, old toys from the 80s. And I was struck. It struck me that all of the advertising done in the 1980s for these toys is still paying dividends for people. There's like a whole industry around selling all these old toys, you know? I was also like at the time watching He-Man commercials. I remember I bought a Sears catalog from the 80s to look at the toys, and it creates like this feeling in me that's like really, really strong emotion, right? And I just started to think about how toy companies and just companies in general that have really been around a long time can utilize this feeling of childhood nostalgia to sell products to adults. And so that's basically that became this book.
You retrace the history of advertising to children using the sort of evolving media. Just talk a little bit about where you began the book.
Yeah, so it goes back really far, because before there was really advertising for products and stuff, there was propaganda, like wartime propaganda, which was, you know, kind of like the first form of advertising to mass groups of people. So we go back that far talking about using propaganda and how effective they are, in the sense that like the repetition and visual aids of posters and stuff like that, and repeating the message over and over again, can get people to fight in war, kill the enemy, things like that. And, you know, then it kind of skips to when the creation of the television, right? And what a commercial is. Commercials kind of existed on the radio, where they would like sponsor programs and things like that. And television started, it was the same, where like the Colgate Comedy Hour, like Colgate toothpaste, would sponsor the whole program.
The GE and, GE Masterpiece Theater and things like that, right?
Yes, yeah, exactly. And, you know, at some point they figured out that they could advertise multiple products on the same show if they created this thing called the commercial break. You know, televisions were, there was like only a few channels, so everything was very broad, like for the whole family to watch. You don't see children's TV and cartoon programming come out until the Flintstones, and it was on in primetime. And they would air the repeats of things in primetime on Saturday mornings, and they found out that kids are the only ones awake on Saturday mornings, and they were watching the Flintstones, and that was kind of like the birth of the Saturday morning cartoon show, which was the first time they were creating programming specifically directed towards children, and the products would be advertising towards children. And in 1970, the government regulated television and said that you can't advertise to kids directly through television. And so you couldn't make a TV show and sell toys of that TV show because that was considered advertising. So that's why you don't see like Scooby-Doo toys from the 70s. Scooby-Doo was huge in the 70s, but there's no Scooby toys. And it was kind of like a golden age for kids. You know, there's this space in between watching TV and playing with your toys. And in that period of time, they found out that media really sells toys because they made toys of things that were in media that weren't necessarily kids' toys. So like the first big toy in the 70s was the Evel Knievel stunt cycle. And it was huge because this guy Evel Knievel was on like Saturday afternoon TV all the time. And, you know, it started selling toys like crazy. But the big thing that changed everything was Star Wars. You know, they had done movie tie-in toys before, but like nothing like this where the property was like out of control popular. And so, you know, they figured out they wanted to use media to sell toys because it changed the game.
Right. Let me stop you right there for a second, because I know that we're on the cusp we're on the cusp of really where your book focuses. Your book focuses on the real boom that happened in the 80s, and Star Wars and what happened there ushered that in. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to ask you about an earlier iteration of the childhood toy, or maybe it wasn't considered the childhood toy. Even before all of that, we had the Disney watch. But how is that different from what came later? Sorry, the Mickey Mouse watch, not the Disney watch.
The thing that Disney got away with is that their stuff wasn't on television. I mean, they had stuff on television, but these characters were on TV. I mean, in movies and stuff like that, which wasn't as highly regulated, you know, in terms of promoting things for children. So that's why you see throughout all of this time, Disney toys and stuff always. Walt Disney especially understood the power of nostalgia because his first movies, the first Disney movies were old properties. You know, he didn't write Snow White. He you know, that was something that he liked when he was a kid. And Peter Pan, same thing. Like Walt Disney played Peter Pan in his high school play. And so he, you know, he was the one that understood like this Peter Pan, like that's that powerful emotion that he's talking about. You know, and he Disneyified everything, and I don't know if he at the time was like, we're going to get hook these kids early and we're going to have lifelong fans and stuff like that. But he essentially did do that.
The first first Mickey Mouse cartoon was Steamboat Willie, right? 1928. Right. Mm-hmm. And then later on, you have those parents then passing Mickey Mouse on to their kids.
Parents that saw Steamboat Willie are the parents took their kids to see Snow White when it came out. And that's why Snow White was so huge. And you know, it was huge anyways, technical achievement. But Disney is the thing. Like Disney, since the beginning, has understood this power of nostalgia.
So that brings us to the 80s. Let's fast forward to that peak period that the book focuses on, the He-Man period. So tell us, what is the He-Man effect?
What happens in the 80s after Star Wars and stuff like that is that through big business lobbying and the Reagan administration, they sought to deregulate television so they could advertise to children directly. And when Reagan was elected in 1980, he ushered that right in. He appointed the head of the FCC, and his belief system was that the TV needs as much regulation as the toaster. So basically no regulation, you know, had to make sure it worked and didn't shock anyone. And that, you know, literally
didn't set the house on fire. But aside from that, we're keeping the hands off.
Aside from that, it's all right. Right. And that just opened the floodgates. And it was like the first generation of people to experience as children, basically 24-hour media advertising, because all of the television programs themselves were essentially commercials for the toys. And then there was commercials also during those shows. So all of the children's television programming was advertised, and it paid off. I mean, it really did. I mean, like, there was a boom in this business model of the cartoon action figure. You know, there was so many. He-Man is one of the most popular, but there was like five He-Man ripoffs at least, and a million other similar type cartoons.
One of the things that really jumped out for me was the fortuitousness of the timing, because this wasn't incidental. It wasn't like, oh, let's make a movie and this movie's doing great, so now we'll make the toys. No, it was all kind of one integrated plan.
Yeah, like, make the movie, make the toys. It was in production before the movie was out.
Absolutely. Yeah. So what would you say in this book are the most pivotal events in the story that you tell? Like, without giving away the entire book, what are the tent poles?
I would say certainly the release of Star Wars and the popularity of the Star Wars figures. And then also, this was like right after that, is the deregulation of media, which started during the Reagan administration. You know, those are really pivotal. And then more recently, I think, you know, the Disney's acquisition of Star Wars kind of like completed a circle. So, you know, I think those are big things.
I'll be able to remember a lot of these details about the evolution of this particular cartoon and toy integrative model. I'll be able to retain a lot of this information because you very effectively put it into a cartoon. It really took, listen, if you strip out the illustrations, this could easily have been a grad school research paper, you know, so delivering in this format really sticks. It's a very effective way to tell stories. I understand that you've done this with the life story of Andre the Giant. You've done this with the life story of Andy Kaufman. So how do you go about selecting which stories you want to tell?
It's funny. I often am researching a book for like many, many years without knowing it. All of a sudden, I've been researching Andre the Giant for like 5-6 years, but just for fun. And then sooner or later, it comes to me like, hey, this kind of would make a good book. Like this one, you know, I had spent a decade at least going back and going over all these different toy franchises and how things worked. And, you know, the Sears catalog from 1986 is almost like a functional Sears catalog because you can look into it and then buy it on eBay. So, yeah, it's usually once I start telling the same stories over and over again to my wife and she's like, you told me this yesterday. That's when I start thinking like, oh, this could be a book.
Would you call this a comic book? You're a cartoonist by trade.
Yeah, it's always like graphic novel, but it's not a novel. So we say graphic nonfiction or documentary comics sometimes.
Because I'm going to tell you, if someone took, what was one of those things I was supposed to read in high school but didn't, King Lear or something like that, and made the right comic book, I might have made it through the whole story. So I want you to talk a little bit about the power of telling complex true stories and histories using cartoon format. This might help bring the scores up nationwide. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I agree. I think comics is it's easy to read, but also aids in comprehension of things. So in emergency situations, on a plane, right, in your seat in front of you, there's a card that tells you what to do in case of an emergency. And if you look at that, that's just a comic. It's a series of images telling you very important information, what you have to do. And it gets that super important information through to everyone very quickly and easily. And that's kind of the power of comics right there, is that you can convey a lot of complex information in simplified terms and entertaining terms, and the images and stuff help move you along. We call it the magic, or like the power of comics.
I think if you were a child in the 80s, you would find this whole story particularly fascinating because it'll resonate with you. It's your contemporary, your experience.
I talk to some 90s kids too that are like, yeah, because it gets towards the end, it gets into how this turned into something else kind of in the 90s. You know, like I talk to some people that are like, oh yeah, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, yeah, Power Rangers, yep. You know, so it's ongoing.
What can subsequent generations, but society overall, right, learn from this story? I mean, what would you want them to take away?
I think it relates very much to just pop culture in general that's going on today. The obsessed fandom that we see with Star Wars, where we're seeing fans pushing people off of off of social media, making people quit acting roles because, you know, a lot of racist things, you know, because they're thinking, you know, they have fans saying this doesn't fit my memory of what Star Wars is. It's kind of trying to explain why are we seeing such, you know, these negative outcomes in terms of super fandom. And it's because it's been like imprinted on our DNA. More recently, Idris Elba turned down 007 role, citing racism from the fans. And that's a 007 is a very old property that goes back a long ways and where people have it imprinted in their DNA in the same way. And also we're seeing the Barbie movie. The Barbie movie is out now and Mattel wants to do a whole slate of films and people are like, what are you doing? Why are we doing this? And I think this book kind of explains why we're seeing things like that now.
I do think that you're doing the public a service in a way because, you know, I think that if the public is aware that this is a drive, it's an artificial drive that's being driven by advertising and sort of coercive techniques, you know, knowledge is power, right?
Yes. Yes. And I think that, like, it's not all bad, right? Like, so this is a natural human emotion. It's good to have memories of your life, you know, and your childhood memories are so precious and powerful because they, like, last forever. Like, I can't remember stuff I did last week, but I can remember playing with toys when I was 4 years old or something. And so it's so powerful. It's such a powerful emotion. And the idea that it's co-opted by corporations feels, it makes it taints it a little bit, I think. There must be some sort of real evolutionary reason for this emotion. And I'm not sure that that reason is so we can continue to buy Star Wars things as we're adults and grandfathers and things like that. And I think that this book is something that can help you understand a little bit more about how advertising works and how much we as a society, you know, overall are being manipulated. And I don't think the answer is you have to, you know, swear off every Disney product and never buy anything ever again. But it's good to know what's going on.
Because knowing is half the battle.
Yep.
I mean, now come on, know. Right?
And knowing is half the battle. G.I.
Joe! All right, so the book is called The He-Man Effect, How American Toy Makers Sold You Your Childhood. And by you, he means those kids of the 80s. I guess I can finally let go of the Voltron thing now that I know what's really going on. Forget about it. But best of luck with the book.
Thank you so much.
And this has been The Book Report. For WTOP News, I'm Tariq King.